Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Simon Phipps joins me. We're going to talk to the Delta Cloud people. They're putting an API in front of all the cloud APIs to make you have just one API to worry about. You're going to want to see this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps, episode 204, recorded on March 14th, 2012, Delta Cloud. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Ford, featuring curve control to help protect against crashes on curves. Look for curve control available in the 2013 Ford Taurus. And you can learn more at ford.com/cars/Taurus. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free Libre open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing to you as often as I can, typically each week, sometimes a few gaps here and there, but typically each week, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, the new projects, the mature projects, all sorts of people doing those projects. But I'm almost always assisted by a co-host, and this week our co-host is none other than one Mr. Simon Phipps. Simon, welcome back to the show.
Welcome back to you. You've been cruising so much recently. You seem to have a rich suntan there, I have to say.
It's just the lighting. The lighting is so bad in this room, it makes me look dark. So I kind of envy you actually that way. But yeah, thank you. January, February are almost always a bad season for me in terms of staying with the show because that's our typical heavy cruise time. So we've had back-to-back cruises in February. So I am back. And in fact, I'm not only back, but we have a guest today who's really interesting. It's going to be fun to talk to this guy. David Luttercourt is a principal software engineer. Does that mean he has a principal's office? I'm not sure how that works. Anyway, he's a principal software engineer for Delta Cloud. Delta Cloud, as far as I can tell from my 45 minutes of skimming that I do right before the show, it's an API adapter. So on one side, you'll have a cloud API that's universal no matter what cloud service you're talking to. And on the other side, it talks all the native APIs like Amazon EC2 and Rackspace and Open Nebula, which I'm particularly interested in because we're doing some of that here at Media Temple. And it talks on the other side to those APIs. So maybe not the sexiest project around, but an interesting project nonetheless, and very necessary now because, you know, it's really bad to get locked in on one project or one system or another. You know, if you build everything with Amazon EC2 APIs, and then you say, oh, no, I'm tired of them, or the prices aren't as good as Rackspace today. You know, how do you move all that stuff over? Have you seen Delta Cloud, Simon, before?
No, this is the first time I've researched it. And looking at it, it looks pretty interesting. It looks like it's doing the same sort of thing for cloud that Java did for computers back in the 1990s. It's virtualizing it and stopping you from getting locked in by giving you a universal API that you can program to that isolates you from the lock-in reptilian tendencies of your suppliers. So I'm going to be pretty interested to hear what he's got to say about it.
Yeah, and I'm pretty interested too, as well. It's just my primary client for the last year has been, basically a hosting company. It's this whole notion of APIs and clouds and stuff is very, you know, familiar to me and very, very interesting to me. So I'm looking forward to talking to him. But before we bring him on, we have a sponsor for this week's show. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Ford, featuring Curve Control. Curve Control is part of a suite of safety technologies on the 2013 Ford Taurus. It helps drivers maintain control of their vehicle while taking a curve too quickly. That sounds dangerous. Here's how Curve Control works. First, it looks for potential problems by measuring how quickly the vehicle is turning versus how quickly the driver is trying to turn it. The roll rate, the yaw rate, the lateral acceleration, the wheel speed, and the steering angle. Calculations run 100 times every second. Ooh. When it finds the problem, Curve Control rapidly reduces engine torque, applies four-wheel braking, and slows the vehicle up to 10 miles an hour in 1 second. Wow. And it works on dry or wet pavement. Curve Control helps protect while driving on curves, and it's one of several new driver-assisted technologies available in the 2013 Ford Taurus. You can learn more about Curve Control at ford.com/cars/Taurus. So let's go ahead and bring in our guest, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Randall. Thanks so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in San Francisco.
Oh, so you're actually going to come into the cottage.
Cities.
You could come into the brick house next to just doing it live, but okay, it's fine. We'll do it this way instead. We're already set up with Skype, so we might as well have the conversation over Skype. That's pretty cool. So at the beginning of the show, I did a sort of overview of what I could grok from like reading for about 20 minutes of what Delta Cloud is. But let's turn to the expert and actually ask, what is Delta Cloud? What problem is it solving?
So the big problem it's addressing is, or part of the login problem with cloud. Today, there's one big front runner, really, Amazon, and a few also-rans, smaller competitors. But each of them has their own API. And no matter what you do with their cloud, you invariably get locked into their API because you start writing scripts, you start writing management applications against that API. And before you know it, that knowledge about that API is so deeply entrenched in the code you've written that it'll be really hard for you to move to another competitor, to a different cloud, maybe move to a cloud you build yourself. So what Delta Cloud does, it's an API adapter. You talk Delta Cloud API on the front to it, and out the back, it talks to the cloud of your choice in the native cloud API. So that when you want to move from one cloud to the other, you're still talking Delta Cloud. You just redirected where your Delta Cloud server is going to do its business.
Yeah, so initially, we've got providers out there like EC2, Amazon. We've got OpenStack. We've got Nebula. All these guys are like out there. Mm-hmm. They didn't all... It seems to me that it would have been smart for them to standardize on a normal API across all of them. And do you know why they didn't do that? Or is
part of it is, when something new's out there, you first focus on getting things done and don't worry so much about the impact and the big landscape. And so a lot of these APIs grew, and I don't want to criticize them for... There's nothing inherently bad about them. On the technical side, they're all reasonably sound. And you can't really come in and standardize on something while you're still exploring the very basics of how it should work. So part of it is just that it's the process. I heard... In terms of what the landscape looks like, my favorite analogy is that we are with cloud where we were with the internet in the early 90s when it looked that everybody would be an AOL user or a CompuServe user, and the question was just which one would have the bigger market share. And luckily, and in part because of standardization efforts and efforts on driving openness, open APIs, and so on. That's not how the whole internet ecosystem has played out. In fact, there's where I am, I have a choice between about 10 or so internet providers. That AOL and CompuServe aren't around anymore is maybe a small byproduct of that process. But what we really want to see in the cloud landscape is that there's vibrant competition between a lot of players. Which will give users and consumers the best choice and the best pace of innovation for infrastructure as a service clouds.
So when I'm using EC2, for example, that's what I have the most familiarity with of all the things this thing ties to. I can go up to a website and start an instance, see if the instance is running, bring it down, whatever I have to do with it. Mm-hmm. Or there's this very complex, which I've never programmed to, but a very complex API that I can talk to it as well. Is that the API that you're saying that Delta Cloud is attaching to?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as you said, you can either go to the console and as a human do it, but if you want to do anything more automated, you go to the API, and it's not really a RESTful API, but it's very close. Mm-hmm. So it's a web API. You have to authenticate to it with encrypting certain request parameters, but you can program in quotes against that API with a bash script and curl by just firing off web requests.
Hmm. And so that's what EC2 is providing. And Delta Cloud is sitting in front of that. Then is it similar? Can I go to a website and do something, or can I go through to write some programs against some other universal API then?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, at the on a 10,000 foot level, the EC2 API and the Delta Cloud API work pretty much the same in terms of the mechanics. It's you address it over HTTP, you make requests by either sending some XML or JSON, and you get back some XML or JSON as the response. So, for example, when you want to start an instance in a cloud, you make a web request, and in that request as query parameters, you say what the image is that that instance should be based on, what realm, what we call a realm, which is a little bit like an availability zone in EC2, it should run in, and a few other parameters. And it's just a post request you make via HTTP. And then the Delta Cloud server turns around and makes a similar request to, say, the EC2 or the Rackspace or whatever API. That will start your instance. And then as a response, in the response, you get some information about the instance. In particular, you get a URL that is specific to that instance. So in the future, when you want to see how your instance is doing, you go to that URL and just make a GET request to that URL, and you get details about that instance, either as XML or JSON. When you create an instance, it usually comes up as pending because it takes cloud providers a little time to do all the provisioning that's needed to start a virtual machine. So generally, you have to sit there and every once in a while do a GET request against that URL you got when you created the instance to see when your instance is running, and then you can SSH into it, or maybe it's running a web server of its own, and you can do stuff with that web server.
Right. Now, I notice you're mentioning the Amazon APIs quite a lot in your answers there. Would you say that Delta Cloud's API was modeled on Amazon's APIs, or do you think it's more general than that?
It's more general than that. It gives you a lot of the capabilities of the Amazon API. But what we did is, with every feature we put in the API, we took a look around all the cloud APIs we could find and modeled them in a way that fits all these cloud APIs. One good example is how you say how big the virtual machine is you want to start. In Amazon, you get a choice between, by now it's probably 12 or so sizes, and each of these, we call them in Delta Cloud hardware profiles, says I want this many CPUs, I want this much RAM, I want this much local storage. So you can start an instance with 2 CPUs, 4 gigs of RAM, 100 gigs of local storage. But other cloud providers do this a little differently. And to model all of them, we had to come up with a model where it's possible to describe ranges of machines. So that you can say, if I have 2 CPUs, you can have between 4 and 8 gigs of RAM, 100 to 200 gigs of local storage, for example. So in that sense, the API is more general to accommodate all these different models of how you express instance sizing in this example.
Right.
That's other places.
Is it possible to mix and match between different providers? So, for example, can I have my processing done by EC2, but mix storage from Eucalyptus and EC2 and S3? In an instance, is that impossible? An impossible sort of thought.
In the sense that you can, that firing off an instance in Eucalyptus, in your local Eucalyptus cloud, in your EC2 cloud, looks exactly the same. It's you can mix and match like that, but we don't magically add capabilities where you can attach storage that's in an Eucalyptus installation to your EC2 instance. We don't do any of that.
Right, but I mean, presumably the Delta Cloud code is running locally on one of my machines here,
and then
connecting to things elsewhere. So presumably it would be reasonable for me to have that code firing some compute tasks off over to Amazon,
and performing
another one locally on Eucalyptus if it's more mission critical or secure.
And the whole point of Delta Cloud is that these requests will look almost the same, so that when you fire off a virtual machine in OpenStack, and then you can go and fire off a virtual machine in, say, your local vSphere installation. Those requests are virtually the same, except for changes in what you call the images, for example, that the instances are based on.
So now that's good for virtualizing the APIs, but aren't the resources that get created by that on the services in formats that are specific to the services that you're using?
They are on those services, but then when you come through Delta Cloud and ask us questions about these resources, we get their native representation from the provider and reformat and give you the same representation, no matter what provider you're using.
Right. But I mean, I think what I'm getting at here is, you know, if I've been using EC2 and S3 for a couple of years, and I've been using Delta Cloud to, I could only have done that since 2011, couldn't I? But if I've been using Delta Cloud to mediate for me, are there going to be any problems if I decide to rehost that with Rackspace? Presumably, there's a load of artifacts that are in internal to Amazon EC2 that you have been masking for me that I'm going to have to somehow port across to Rackspace.
I think the biggest one I can think of is if you use, what Delta Cloud doesn't address, and that's why I said it's only part of the puzzle of addressing the lock-in problem, is that, you know, a lot of clouds give you internal services like a hosted database or Memcached or whatnot. If you rely on those, then Delta Cloud doesn't give you an answer. We have a separate project, Aeolus, that's addressing that part of the puzzle. But yeah, I mean, Delta Cloud by itself won't make porting completely painless. It's one of the things you need to use to make porting painless, but there are other ingredients you need to.
Right. So you know, one way to describe Delta Cloud would be it's kind of it does for cloud what Java did for web applications. It generalizes them from the platform and the hardware.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's.
So now I'm looking down your list of drivers here, and I notice that you don't seem to have one for Microsoft Azure. Why is that?
We looked at Azure a while ago, and we actually have a driver that addresses the storage side of Azure, so you can store blobs and buckets in Azure as you can in many other clouds. The thing, though, is that on the compute side, Azure doesn't really fit very well in the infrastructure as a service paradigm. We looked at the API and just couldn't come up with a good way to fit it into the various models and objects we have in the API, and took a step back from that. We might, if there's demand for it, we might take another stab at it.
Right. So, I mean, this is why I was getting at the model point earlier on, was that one of the problems you have when you're abstracting a service like this is you do tend to, you create an abstract model that's based on what you understand from the services you've used. And then later you can find there are services that don't fit that model and therefore can't be abstracted.
Yeah.
Is that what's happening here with Azure?
Yeah. Because Azure has a very strong platform as a service flavor to it. It's not a good fit for to present in an infrastructure as a service API.
So there are some other players in this space too. Like I think LiveVert is trying to do the same thing. How would you compare yourself to the other players in this space?
Yeah. So LibVert is actually a great example to bring up, because a lot of how we go about things, we model on LibVert. Mm-hmm. LibVert, I think, has been spectacularly successful in providing a standard API for dealing with hypervisors. But LibVert works on a much lower level, in that it talks about hypervisors. What you use to manage KVM or a number of other hypervisors. And Delta Cloud lives, much higher up the stack on the infrastructure as a service cloud level. So we don't even know what hypervisors a lot of these clouds use, at least not in the API, and we don't care.
Ah, right. Okay. So that wouldn't, it was only, I mixed those two concepts in my head. Is there anybody else that's playing in this space then?
There's a number of library projects, there's JClouds. Mm-hmm. For Java, there's something called Fog for Ruby, there's Bodo and LibCloud for Python, and those are libraries that attempt to solve the cross-cloud API puzzle from more of a local perspective, in that you talk to the library, it's in your process, and it out the back talks to the various clouds. The big difference with Delta Cloud is that Delta Cloud is a RESTful a web service API, and that makes it attractive for a number of reasons. One of them is that you can just adopt the API. You don't need to use our code. You can just adopt the API definition and re-implement it yourself. And there's a few small cloud providers that have actually done that, which is not something you can do with a library API. And of course, because it's a web service API, it's also not language dependent. If your favorite programming language is Intercal and there's no cross-cloud library for it, you're a host on that front, but you can still use the Delta Cloud API since it's web-based. Assuming anybody can figure out how to make a web request in Intercal.
I think you're the third guest I've had in the 200 shows we've done that actually has mentioned Intercal by name. So thank you for bringing that up again. There's 100 people now that are going off to Google trying to figure out what the hell it is. But yeah, I know what it is. Great joke. Good joke. So you said that some cloud providers have actually taken this code and adopted it as a secondary API for their API?
Actually, as their primary API.
Oh.
One of the ones I know of is a outfit called Bscale in the Czech Republic, which seems to be a pretty well going cloud provider for the Czech market. And any small cloud provider has the problem of what API should they offer. They can either just homebrew something, but then their customers will have to adapt to that API. And if you're small, chances are your customers are using other clouds too. So you're just increasing the overhead for your users. You can go and emulate an existing cloud API, and there's been voices out there, like Mark Shuttleworth recently had a huge blog post on how everybody should just adopt EC2, the EC2 API. By adopting an API that's driven by one single vendor, you're running into huge risks as a cloud provider that API might take turns that don't agree with your strategy and with your needs, and you just have no seat at the table. There's no way to influence where this API goes. And a third option is to either adopt a standard or open source API like Delta Cloud, you're joining the ranks of people who already use that API, and you give your customers client code and things like that that are already out there, because Delta Cloud, when we don't just write the server, the Delta Cloud server, we also write a number of clients that make it easy to consume the API from Ruby, Python, Java, and so on.
And you just mentioned we, and I was going to bring up, what's the development team like on this? What size and how many people are contributing, and are you getting outside contributions outside of Red Hat at this point?
Yeah, we are. So the core team is it's probably three people at this point, including me. Mm-hmm. And then there's a number of contributors. We've had a lot of contributions from cloud providers to write drivers so that Delta Cloud supports their cloud. IBM wrote the driver for their Smart Business Cloud. We had help from Rackspace to write the Rackspace driver. Right now there's a guy from Fujitsu working on a driver for the Fujitsu Global Cloud. On that front, we've had a lot of contributions. Eucalyptus adapted the EC2 driver we had to work well with Eucalyptus, and a lot of these drivers are maintained by people that work that are somehow involved with these clouds. And then the core part of the server, like the front end and some of the internal processing, is mostly what we, the core team, do.
Now, as these other APIs change, I like what you're saying, though, that the Eucalyptus team is helping maintain the Eucalyptus driver. Mm-hmm. But what risk do you have of not staying up on the API changes that are being made by these other 20 vendors?
The big risk is that cool new features that show up in these APIs don't have a counterpart in the Delta Cloud API. That's something that, but usually we're pretty responsive when there is demand for something that showed up in some API. It's usually not a huge amount of work to support it. The hardest part is often to figure out how it best fits into the Delta Cloud API. By now we have various mechanisms to make sure that you as a user can use as many of the cloud specific features without tying yourself into the cloud, into the specific cloud. For smaller features, it's relatively easy for us to add them to the API and add support to that to specific drivers.
Now, at any time there's a translator like this, something can get lost in the translation, to use the human term of this. What's the biggest, I mean, like, two things in the native API might map to one thing logically in your API and vice versa. So how do you go about deciding that and handling that?
We've been very careful to design the API so that, you know, we don't have to make multiple requests with one Delta Cloud request, which limits in a way what we can do. There's one example is in EC. You know, we've had a lot of demand for, and Amazon, I think, has had that demand, that when you create an instance in EC2, that you can assign a name to it on creation, and that that's atomic with a creation. It's very useful for management systems to keep track of, you know, what they've created and how these things fit into the bigger resources they're managing. And so we tried to add that into the Delta Cloud API, even though Amazon doesn't support it natively, and that failed horribly. What we did was we did what Amazon recommends you should do, and you know, you create the instance, and then in a separate call, you tag the instance with a name. And we had too many problems because of these two calls that we had to remove that feature again.
So I'm quite interested by some of the community things you were saying to Randall just a moment ago. Who wrote this code originally? Was it all written by Red Hat, or is it a collaborative effort?
It started with an idea that came out of Red Hat that, you know, we looked around what's going on in the cloud landscape, and APIs were clearly one point where lock-in is likely, and lock-in is a big danger. So we thought about ways how to address that, and out of that came Delta Cloud. It was initially written by, mostly written by a guy from Red Hat called Bob McWhirter. He's well known in the Java JBoss world, and then I came. This was in the about 2.5 or so years ago. I joined the project about 2 years ago, and we started as just a Red Hat project. Thought we'd just create a community around it, as we've done with many things we started. But we talked to car partners and customers, and some of the feedback we got was, this is a great idea, but we're not comfortable with it being a Red Hat project. It just smells too much like we're just getting in bed with another vendor that's trying to sell us their API. So to alleviate those concerns, and because we don't want this to be a Red Hat effort at all, we think this by itself, the more in there, the better for the cloud ecosystem. To address this concern, we took it to the Apache Software Foundation, went through incubation, and then actually graduated to a top-level project last fall.
All right, so that took you, about a year and a quarter to get through a Apache incubator?
Mm-hmm. And the process can be really, really annoying. There were releases where I was banging my head against the wall because somebody found a missing copyright notice or something like that there. But in the end, it was really well worth it. I can highly recommend the incubation process. It can be frustrating at times, but I know I sleep better at night knowing that people have looked over it and there's no dumb lawsuit lurking anywhere.
So in terms of that incubation process, I know that to get out of incubation at Apache, you have to show your project is diverse. And yet you said your core was really just three Red Hat engineers.
Yeah.
How do you manage to graduate with just that core?
So core in terms of sending patches, the actual project management committee, which is what Apache looks at, over the course of incubation, we added committers, mostly people who work on the drivers. So they're probably not as active in the code part, but they're part of the committee and part of the governance structure.
Right. And do you have very much turnover of participation in that project at the moment, or is it still pretty much the people who started it?
It's pretty much the people who came during incubation, I think, is the way to look at it.
So why is Red Hat willing to spend money on this? Is it purely to undermine the lock-in of competitors, or is there some business angle as well for you?
I don't know of any business angle. As far as I can tell, it's mostly a technical and community concern that's driving this. We're using it in our products. We're using it, for example, in the Aeolus project, which we productize as Cloud Forms. And I think there's going to be a podcast on ALS a couple of weeks from today. But yeah, there's, I mean, Delta Cloud itself, I doubt that we'll see that as a by itself as a product. It's going to be a component in things, and it's going to allow us to do things in a way, in the way we would like them to do. That I think is where Red Hat self-interest lies. But the, you know, the bigger picture still is the overriding factor that we want to see a vibrant cloud world with lots of competition, lots of innovation.
Right, you keep on saying ALS. Aren't they the patent trolls that sued the internet?
Oh, this is with an... No, that's the good ALS. The All one right. I'm talking about is A-E-O-L-U-S, the Greek god of winds. It's a cloud broker.
And right,
it's
right.
ALSproject.org.
Right. So, and is that project related to your project in some way?
It's related in the sense that it's one of our users. So, they use Delta Cloud to isolate themselves from specific cloud APIs. ALS is a cloud broker, so you can say, oh, I have these, I have accounts in these five clouds here, and then you say, bring up a web server, and then ALS goes and figures out which of these five clouds you have access to. It should actually bring up the web server you want.
Actually, Randall is telling me on chat down here that we've got ALS coming up on Floss Weekly in a couple of weeks' time. So
yeah.
I'm guessing we'll hear a lot more about that then. So the other thing I was going to ask you about was about standards. Mm-hmm. Is your project based on standards in some way?
When we started the project there, we looked around. There wasn't really anything out there. And so we decided to go the route that we went with Libvirt by... defining a quasi-standard, a de facto standard with an open source implementation. Since then, there has been a lot of activities in standards bodies, and we actively participate in the Distributed Management Task Force working group. They're the ones who are defining an infrastructure as a service API standard called CIMI. I think that stands for Cloud Infrastructure Management Interface. And as part of our activity in the working group, our activity in the working group is a big part is what you expect, talking to people, working on drafts, figuring out ways to address specific issues. But a big part of our participation is also that we're working on an open source implementation of this upcoming CIMI standard. What that means is that in parallel to the, let's call it the classic homegrown Delta Cloud API, we also offer a front end that you can talk CIMI to. And that does the same thing that Delta Cloud always did, which is you talk CIMI up into the front of the server, and out the back it goes to various clouds,
right.
And does its work. And we see that as really important for a few reasons. One of them, of course, is it's great to prove a standard while it's still under deliberation by implementing as much as you can of it, just to get some hands-on experience and kind of avoid the gotcha, oh God, we didn't realize this is impossible to implement later on. Another big part of it is I'm sure there are, not every player in the cloud market is a member of the DMTF and participates in this working group. So by having Delta Cloud, it will be possible to use CIMI against the APIs of providers who won't support it natively.
Right. So why didn't DMTF simply adopt Delta Cloud's API? I mean, it's open source. It's at Apache. It looks pretty safe.
Yeah, I think they still look at Delta Cloud very much as a Red Hat thing, and they didn't want to give... there are various members in that group who submitted... API, their APIs as kind of a starting point for a standard. And the group didn't want to favor any one vendor by just adopting the API wholesale. That in my recollection, is the biggest reason why the
group worked. So I do hope you're not going to end up with Corba at the end of all this.
No. It's a very nice, RESTful API. It's in usage, it is very similar to Delta Cloud.
Right. So are you having to do a rewrite of Delta Cloud to make this CIMI stuff work?
It's actually, surprisingly, there there has been very little rewrite on the back end we needed to do. Most of the code we had to write is in the places where you would expect it, which is dealing with incoming requests, transforming the XML that's in a request into some internal object, passing that off to the back end to do something with it, and then taking what the back end produces and serializing it to XML or JSON. So it's the work has been really, really more on the front end wallpaper side for the most part.
Well, that's a pretty good endorsement of your original abstraction,
I was very surprised by that. I know there's a few dragons that we haven't addressed yet that will probably cause some head scratching to really get them working end to end. But so far, it's been pretty smooth.
So actually, somebody in the chat room just asked a question. I think I danced around this a little bit, which is, so what cloud providers actually do provide the Delta Cloud API as their native API?
Yeah, the two I know of and can talk about are this outfit in the Czech Republic, Bscale. Mm-hmm. And actually, the second one, I'm not sure if I can talk to them.
Okay. Maybe it's an upcoming feature and you just can't talk about it yet, I presume. Okay. Yeah. And I'm also curious now, in order to do the work, I'm talking to my Delta Cloud installation, mm-hmm. and it's then talking to with the API to the actual cloud providers. So it has to know my credentials to be able to get over to the cloud mm-hmm. providers, right? So this seems like it would be a great place for somebody to attack if they wanted to break into something. Have you thought about hardened security for some installation like this? And so how does that work out?
Depending on your level of comfort, on the technical side, we don't store any credentials on the server. So there's nothing to steal except for things that are in flight. With every request, you need to send us your credentials as an HTTP basic authentication header. Mm-hmm. That still leaves room for people to attack the server and steal your secrets as they're in flight. I don't see that as very different from any web application that can be attacked. So you should use the standard ways of securing your servers for Delta Cloud. So in particular, only talk HTTPS to your Delta Cloud server. Mm-hmm. If you want to really be secure, run it on in an environment that you completely control, do sensible firewalling and all those things.
Yeah, it'd probably be a bad idea to run your Delta Cloud installation in the cloud, right?
Well, we actually have one running in the cloud. We have a public endpoint. As I said, it depends on your level of comfort with the provider. Most of these cloud APIs actually only hand out keys that are easy to revoke. So you can, if you play with them, I would generate a new key. If you use the public endpoint, generate a new key, use that for that, and then destroy it after you're done with your exploration.
Yeah, makes sense. So let's talk about implementation. What's this written in, and how many lines of code is it?
It's not written in Perl, I have to say. It's written in Ruby. Mm-hmm.
That's okay. Ruby's the daughter of Perl. It's okay. It's allowed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm sure, yeah. We use a web framework called Sinatra. Mm-hmm. I do not know the lines of code off the top of my head. I mean, I could run WC real quick here, but I think it's a little too disruptive for the podcast.
And don't worry about that. Yeah, okay. I was just saying if you knew off the top of your head. So, and how does have a public repo? Can people see the changes as being committed?
Yeah. As an Apache project, everything is in a Apache provided repo. We just recently, maybe 6 weeks or so ago, we migrated from Subversion to Git.
Yay.
I was. Nobody was happier about that than me.
Huge congratulations achieving that. I know that other projects at Apache have had a much harder time than you with that.
Yeah. Apache. I mean, things are really starting to move in that direction at Apache. We're part of. It's still. I think Git support is still experimental at Apache, but they've opened the gates much wider for various projects. It was a bit of an unfortunate transition when we went to the ASF, to the incubator, because we had everything in Git, and once you use Git, you get so used to it and so used to working with branches and rebases and all that.
Absolutely.
And Subversion is doesn't give you that level of comfort.
Actually, it's been a source of endless pain for the OpenOffice project in trying to migrate. They weren't even using Git. They were using Mercurial. But they suffered agony trying to squeeze a gallon into a pint pot.
Yeah. Having said all that, the ASF, though, they give you, for all the Subversion repos, I think they have mirrors both on git.apache.org and on GitHub. So if you're not a core committer, it doesn't really matter to you. You can modify your favorite project in Git by just working against those Git mirrors and then send in patches.
Right. So I noticed that there is another initiative that seems to look a lot like this that Red Hat's involved in at Oasis called Tosca. What's your relationship to that? Is that duplicative?
No, Tosca is on a higher level. So the DMTF CME is strictly an infrastructure as a service API. Tosca works more on the application level. Tosca is about describing complicated, 3-tier, multi-tier applications with databases and caches and web servers and all that, and how to manage their life cycle.
In
CME, we only talk about machines and very more low-level concepts than what Tosca talks about.
So it seems that this whole space of defining a universal cloud API control function, it seems it's very fragmented and still very young. What do you think are the next steps in this space of abstracting cloud? Are we going to see some kind of a unified initiative that's got programming APIs, storage APIs, deployment capabilities, DevOps, SysOps, all integrated into a single environment, or is it always going to be a mosaic of different pieces?
Yeah, I think it's going to stay a mosaic of a lot of pieces. On the API front, I think the DMTF CME will make a huge impact in that it comes with an ecosystem of industry vendors that are behind it. And so has a really good chance of being an open and widely adopted API. And hopefully that will put the kind of balkanization of infrastructure as a service APIs, that whole landscape to rest. There's other lots of other aspects of cloud that haven't been addressed and aren't addressed by CME, that haven't really been addressed by a lot of standards bodies, be it services, right? How do you standardize hosted databases, hosted caches, and all that. I think there are multiple efforts needed. In terms of just applications and code, I think the next big thing we'll see is cloud brokers. This idea of abstracting you away from the specific cloud you run in, and letting you launch your compute in various clouds based on policy, based on fairly flexible criteria. I'd never thought about this until I started working in cloud and thinking about it a little bit. When I talk to my family in Germany, I have no idea who routes the call. I have no idea how many phone providers are actually involved in making this call happen. And I hope that with a lot of varied efforts, we can get cloud to that point where you have some compute tasks you want to get done, but you don't need to be conscious of all the different parties involved in doing that, or who in particular is servicing your where the VM is actually running in the end.
Right. So after you've got CIMI implemented, and you seem to have a pretty good range of drivers for different cloud architectures here, what's next for the project? Is it moving into gracious old age like HTTPD has done, or is there some new departure that Delta Cloud is going to be innovating in?
Yeah, that's a good question. We still have a lot of work to do on the CME front, and anybody who thinks we're done is sorely mistaken. It would be great if anybody who wants to polish their Ruby skills is more than welcome to come in and ask questions, send patches. Would be great. But assuming, thinking forward to the point in time where this is all done, CME is a standard, it's and we have an open source implementation of it. I think part of it will be to serve as a test bed for new ideas. You can prove out in code in an open source way, and then take back to the DMTF Cloud Working Group as a suggestion for enhancements in standard. I would also love to see that something we've had way too little time to address some sort of test suite and run against CIMI APIs to at least give you a feel for how close to the actual standard these things are, these implementations are. There's a huge amount of work there, but my big hope is that that it will, the Delta Cloud community will help innovate, will be a tool for trying out things.
That'd be a great future use for it as well. And you can always write more tests too. I mean, that's a never-ending bucket to dig into, is to write more and more tests, because I know that always gets pretty crazy that way. We've chatted for a bit about Delta Cloud now, and I just wanted to ask you a couple of final questions, but the one most important final question is that have we left anything out that you want to make sure our audience is aware of about Delta Cloud?
No, I think we've covered everything I thought I wanted to cover.
Okay, and I guess I already know your favorite programming language, so I don't need to ask that, right?
Yeah, right now it's my favorite practical programming language. I still cry tears over Lisp, Scheme, I started looking at OCaml, which is a great language. But it's if you want to write code that others can contribute to, you have to go with something that's popular.
Scalar is your friend.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I haven't had time to play with Scalar, but I hear great things about it.
And again, my fans would yell at me if I didn't ask the next question, which is Emacs or Vi or something else.
Emacs, absolutely, hands down.
Oh, because of the Lisp aspect of it, right?
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah,
very nice.
I'm very glad. I taught myself a couple of weeks ago how to cut and paste in Vi. That says a lot about how much I use it.
Every once in a while, if I'm just SSH into a host, I don't want to wait for the 2 extra seconds it takes to fire up Emacs. I'll say VI file, even though
exactly.
I'm then typing it for like 5 minutes to remember my VI hands back again. Yeah. But it's I have an Emacs session running on my server, my main server for Stonehenge.com, that sits inside a tmux process. So it actually is running for about 3 months at a time.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, I have to reboot Emacs. I shut it down and start up with a new load just to clean everything out.
In grad school, I had a professor who had to cancel an exam because he had lost the actual exam questions in his Emacs buffers. He couldn't, he had so many Emacs buffers open, he couldn't find it anymore. That's my great aspiration.
Yeah, sometimes when I list buffers, it goes down about 4 or 5 pages, and I go, I should probably delete some of these. Yeah. That's probably a good thing to do. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's been very pleasurable. Sorry. Yeah, it's been very pleasurable having you on. Thank you for talking about Delta Cloud with us. I'm sure now a bunch of people are looking at this as a possible API. I know that, here's my primary client here. We're looking at doing APIs. It sounds like this might be a good place to start, at least in terms of having a native API for the materials that are happening here. And if we implement something like Open Nebula behind it, then it'll just let this code sit right in the middle, and it would have either the Open Nebula API or the Delta Cloud API.
Yeah. Open Nebula is one of the clouds we support, and they're also thinking about using that as a cloud abstraction in the backend for bursting. But yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was great talking to you and Simon.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you, David. That was David Littercourt, who I probably just mispronounced his name, and hopefully he's gone already. But anyway, talking to us about Delta Cloud. Simon, what did you think?
It's a very interesting project. When you're starting up a new technology area like this, it's natural for all the innovators to do their own thing in quirky ways, which either intentionally or unintentionally lock everyone into their technology. And so having an abstraction layer is naturally a good thing to have. And I think they've done a fine job. They did a great job getting through the Apache incubator. Very nimble footwork to get through it in only a year and a quarter. There's projects that have been in there for years and years and years. And they seem to be doing pretty well at getting driver support for what they're doing and with sticking to standards. So the whole story looks pretty good to me.
You know, Simon, actually, I'm a bit embarrassed that I didn't know what the incubator project is about, or what the incubator project system is about. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because I don't think we've even talked about that on the show much.
Right. Well, I mean, you do need to get somebody from Apache to come on. I saw them down there on the schedule because I'm probably the last person they want speaking for them. But they had a lot of projects wanting to join Apache once upon a time. And they were a little bit worried that some of those projects were wanting to join in order to stuff corporate technology into Apache and use it for kind of market branding. And so what they did was they created an insulation layer, if you will. So incubation is the place that new projects go at Apache in order to make sure that they know how to play by Apache's rules, that they're diverse enough, they've got enough different contributors, that all of their licensing fits in with Apache's way of doing licensing, that their community management and engagement styles are right. And so incubation makes sure that you can't just become a new Apache project at the top level, what they call a top-level project, that you go into the incubator and you prove yourself, and after you've proven yourself, then you get to become a full Apache project. And so Apache has now got a huge number of top-level projects, but they have an even larger number of projects sitting in incubation trying to prove that they really are worthy of becoming Apache projects and aren't just transient or marketing stunts by vendors.
Well, thanks for the explanation for that. I actually wasn't aware of that process. As up as I am on most of the open source stuff, I barely heard about this. So I guess I'm going to have to pay more attention next time when somebody talks about being an Apache project or an incubator project. Speaking of projects, speaking of upcoming projects, we have a number of upcoming projects on the short list. We have a few that are actually scheduled. I need to actually get back and start typing some emails out again. Next week we have, thanks to you, Simon, we have Michael Meeks and Charles Schultz coming to us, talking to us about the LibreOffice. You mentioned was LibreOffice the one that went through incubation too, or is that something else?
No. It's the Oracle gave the OpenOffice.org trademarks and brand name to Apache. And so there's a brand new project going through incubation at Apache that's going to take on those brand names and produce projects mainly driven by IBM. They're heading towards a new release. But no, LibreOffice is the fork that the community did. It's going from strength to strength, just done its 3.5 release. It's looking pretty cool. Just got incorporated as an independent nonprofit foundation.
Great, cool. So we'll have that on next week. Sounds like a really interesting project to have on. And immediately following that, we mentioned them a couple times in this show, the Aeolus project. Going to talk to us about that higher level layer, the cloud management layer that sits in front of the Delta Cloud and the talks that manages all your services. We have also scheduled already, we have Sean Schofield, I guess that's right, talking to us about Spree Commerce, which is a big shopping cart management sort of system to make sure that you can set up a commercial sales site real easily. And also Liz Quilty, who's a big person in open source communities, is going to come on and just to be Liz Quilty. She's got some projects she's working on too, but she's going to come on and just be a personality. We haven't done a show like that in a while, so I thought it would be a good idea to do that. And then on the short list, we've got a number of other people. We've got a couple rescheduling being done of the shows we had canceled recently. So we get all those in. If you want to find out who we have, we go to twit.tv/floss, and the big spreadsheet is linked from there. If you want somebody else to be on the show that's not on that list, not on the short list, you can have them email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. You can follow us to find out who's being added I'm trying to remember. Boy, I'm stumbling today. The tea is cooled off too much. I can't talk anymore. So follow us on Floss Weekly, either on Identica or Twitter. We also have a Google Plus page that gets updated regularly by me and the other co-hosts. You can follow me, Merlin, MERLYN, on Twitter. I say quite a few things there on Twitter every day. And you can also follow me on Google Plus. I post about 5 or 6 interesting links there every day. If you're following me on those, you would know already that I'm going to be in Amsterdam, the city, I guess. Well, what else would it be, right? The city? On the 10th and 11th of April, both of those evenings, I'm just heading into a cruise starting the following day. So if you're in Amsterdam or nearby, follow my tweets, and maybe we'll probably have a tweet up somewhere in the city that I can get to. And I'm also going to be overnight in Geneva on the 19th of April. So if you're, again, in the Geneva area or close by, follow my tweets at Merlin or follow my Google Plus posts, and you'll be able to hang out with me for a bit. Simon, where can we find you, and where would that be?
So the first place that we could meet up, if you would like to, is at the Open Rights Group conference, which is this Saturday in London. Next Saturday in London, the 24th. And I'll be moderating a session that's all about open source and schools. I'm also going to be at the Spring UK Conference for Floss UK in Edinburgh on the 20th to the 22nd of March. You can find me online at webmink.com. And from there, you'll find links to all the other places that I'm hanging out on Twitter and Identica and on Google Plus. I've just started a new column on infoworld.com. I've taken over the open sources column. And so I'd love you to read that, follow it, and click the like button lots of times so my editor knows that I'm worth keeping. And thank you very much there. Of course, I'm still writing for Computer World UK and still blogging on webmink.com. That's it for me for the plugging for this week, Randall.
Thank you, Simon, for co-hosting today's show.
My pleasure. It's been a great pleasure to come here and bring the cat hairs on my sweater along for everyone to see.
Wonderful, wonderful. And again, the last thing I have to do on this show is to say we'll see you all again next time on Floss Weekly.